Welcome back to Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman 95.9 FM. I'm your host, Dr. Nurse Nancy. Our producer is Robin Fly. Today's show is about some concerns that have occurred to me as I've gone about my nursing duties for hospice patients and with residents of assisted living facilities. In the last half hour, we talked about the situation of mentally competent adults who can't access medical aid in dying and how they might use voluntary stopping eating and drinking to hasten their own death. We also talked about a new tool that might help people with an actual or potential diagnosis of dementia have more control over how long and in what condition they continue to live. An advanced healthcare directive stating whether and how long you want to be spoon-fed if you're no longer able to feed yourself due to Alzheimer's or a similar disease. Detailed information was provided by Judith Schwartz, Clinical Director of End of Life Choices New York, and on the KGVM website, we will link to some of the resources she shared because we can definitely use that information here in Montana. Now I'd like to turn to another area of concern that, like the topics we just discussed, has to do with dignity at the end of life. We're going to hear about working conditions for caregivers. I have a special interest in caregivers working in assisted living facilities because I was one. I know firsthand that compared to what is typically considered more senior staff, including nurses, caregivers spend the most time with residents and know them best. Caregivers are usually the only staff who see a resident's entire body and can report skin breakdown, which can be a huge problem among some elderly people. Caregivers routinely perform tasks that many might consider unappealing, such as changing disposable briefs and pull-ups for people who are incontinent, but these jobs need to be done. Caregivers are more likely to be injured because their work involves transferring residents who have trouble standing, and in these moments, caregivers are literally holding residents' lives in their hands. Yet caregivers at assisted living facilities are grossly underpaid. When I hired on as a caregiver at an assisted living facility about 5 years ago, I started at $12.50 an hour. All of us in Gallatin Valley know that's not really a living wage, and I suspect that wages have gone up due to the labor shortage, and I think that's good, but the wage is more than just what we use to pay the bills. A lot of the time, it's also an indication of how we are valued. And in spite of the crucial work caregivers do, they aren't always valued the way they should be. Hours can be very unpredictable, training can be super limited, and the hard work can be made to seem almost invisible, as if it didn't even happen, because it often happens behind closed doors. As a result, care for residents and patients suffers, so this is about dignity and quality of life for residents and patients at the end of life, but it's also about dignity and quality of life for care providers. The two go together. I believed this when I was a caregiver at an assisted living facility. I knew this when I became a nurse at an assisted living facility. I realized it even more personally when my own mother moved into an assisted living facility. And I'm even more convinced of this now that I provide hospice care in assisted living facilities. Dignity and quality of life are important for caregivers as a matter of justice. Dignity and quality of life are important for residents and patients as a matter of care. And I believe that ensuring caregivers receive the money and training and respect they deserve does right by them, and just a little down the line, does right by patients too. I hope that in a future show, we can highlight some of the innovative proposals that are out there to make this happen in assisted living facilities and other settings. Meanwhile, caregiving doesn't happen just in assisted living facilities. There are unpaid family caregivers in homes across the country, and I see them all the time in my work as a nurse. Perhaps on a later show, we will delve more deeply into the situation of unpaid family caregivers. Today, we'll pretty much focus on people whose paid job is caregiving. There are caregivers who work as independent contractors for individual patients, and there are caregivers who work for agencies that assign them to various patients. There are certified nursing assistants, or CNAs, who work in hospitals and nursing homes and hospices and other settings. And while they have formal training that enables them to work closely with nurses, they often still provide many of the crucial services that non-CNA caregivers offer. Join me now in listening to a presentation, Caregivers Are the Backbone of Our Society. This presentation was given by Alicia Garza for Endwell, which gave us permission to use it.
My mother died April 30th of this year. It was 7 weeks from diagnosis to death. I had just flown in from wherever I was, and I got a text from my dad. Said he needed to talk to me about something important. When we talked later that evening, he told me that my mom hadn't been acting like herself. Having grown up as the grown-up in the family, I thought maybe they had had an argument or something had happened, and I wasn't really sure. But as he began to describe her symptoms, I felt a tightness in my chest. They found a mass in my mom's brain. My mom was on the phone, and so I had to explain to her what was happening. "Mom," I said, "they found a tumor in your brain." "Oh," she said, childlike. A woman who I had known as so capable, so intelligent. Suddenly I couldn't tell, was she processing what I was saying to her? Or was she really unaware of what was going on? She got disoriented really, really quickly, looking for the bathroom outside. She moved in silence, like always, which meant that we had to adjust our attention spans because she's creeping around and then you look up and she's outside next to the swimming pool. We all had to quickly learn how to pay close attention to the woman who paid close attention to us. Now, a week prior, I had just launched an organization focused on building Black political power. Everything had to be put on hold. I spent a week in Northern California cooking and cleaning, talking to relatives about what was going on, even though I had no answers, soothing my father, who was faced with the prospect of losing his partner of more than 30 years before he thought it was time. I had to teach him how to use the washing machine, how to use the dishwasher. We had to find a doctor. And trust me, internet searches are not great when your loved one is suffering and you can't tell who's who, who's an expert, who's not an expert, who's going to be the best for her particular case. One day my mom was walking and she was talking. The next day she was not. A scheduled MRI turned into a rush to the emergency room as there was bleeding in her brain, likely from the tumor, and she'd lost consciousness. She needed immediate surgery to stop the bleeding and drain the fluid that was building in her brain. She needed a shunt installed, and then she needed another MRI, but under sedation. We spent 4 weeks in the hospital, 2 of those weeks in the ICU, meeting new doctors and nurses, meeting families, some of whom had success stories, others who were losing their loved ones. And each moment in a place like that is uncertain, and it's a roller coaster. Some days my mom would be lucid and she would be herself. Other days she would be unconscious or sleeping. We had no real answers as to what was going on with her for 4 weeks. The day the doctor told us that my mother was dying, that there was no treatment that she could survive that would deal with the localized cancer and the cancer that had spread across her brain, was the day that our lives changed forever. You see, moving my mom, just 63 years old, not a wrinkle in sight, into hospice care was unlike anything I'd ever experienced. Now, we all know that we're going to die eventually, and we do a lot of things to prevent that day from coming sooner than we think it should. Botox, exercise, or like my partner's 95-year-old grandmother, her solution is eat nothing white. But hospice was a dimension that was completely new to me. For our family, hospice became about embracing death, embracing the life that we have left with as much agency and dignity as possible. For my family, it wasn't possible for my mom to die at home. They lived 3.5 hours away. My dad did not know how to be a caregiver. And we couldn't imagine having a caregiver move in to their home 3 hours from the rest of my family's support system. Working closely with the palliative care team at UCSF, who I will forever be grateful for, we were welcomed into the Zen Hospice Center. Now, you might know that Zen Hospice was established in the mid-1980s to afford dignified care for people who were dying on the streets, who were dying in SROs, and certainly during the height of the AIDS crisis here in San Francisco, Zen Hospice Project took care of people with AIDS whose families had abandoned them. When we entered Zen Hospice, I'm pretty sure I cried with relief. So did my mama when she arrived later that day. I have a picture of her wearing one of her signature big-brimmed hats. She had become accustomed to wearing those hats because she was very self-conscious about the stitches on the top of her head. She was wearing a t-shirt that said, "Phenomenal Woman." It was the first time in 4 weeks that she had worn regular clothes. Hospitals are not fun environments. Now, of course, I'm grateful for every doctor who explained something to me for the 100th time about what was going on with my mom, or who made sure that we as a family didn't kill each other before my mom passed away. I'm also grateful to every single overnight nurse who chased my mom up and down the hallways of UCSF during many of her manic moments. At Zen, though, my mom had a chef that would make anything she wanted. She had her own bedroom that overlooked the garden. There was only 6 residents there at any given time. No fluorescent lights, no constant noise, so she could actually sleep. Zen let us experience and experiment with what was best for my mom to meet the needs that she had at any given moment. Sometimes that meant cannabis oil because she wasn't eating or because she needed to sleep. Sometimes what that meant was a signature lemon pound cake to satisfy her sweet tooth. Other times it meant giving her access to a glass or 3 of wine that she became accustomed to over the last 30 years or so. Sorry, Mom. It was also close, so I could visit whenever I needed to. You see, hospice wasn't just for my mom. It was for the entire family. We all became intertwined, and we all received the care that we needed to embrace the moment that we were in. The volunteers there learned that my mom loved to have her nails done, so once a week, they would do her nails. She was really self-conscious about how she looked, because I told you again, she had the scar and the shunt thing, and she was dry and had tape marks all over her. So we brought in a stylist to make her feel beautiful again. You see, I talked with hospice nurses at least once a week to get updates on her prognosis. Mom always had a big smile for everybody that she loved and even people she didn't know. But there was times when she was withdrawn and deep inside of herself. One day, a hospice nurse told me that my mom sobbed the night before. She remembered that her own mother had passed away. She became conscious that she was passing away. And she said to the nurse, "I'm not ready to die." And they sat and they held each other in the middle of the night. What would we have done without a caregiver to be there for her in that moment when she needed them the most? My mom died on April 30th, 7 months ago last week. I was holding her hand when she took her last breath. I imagine that's how it should be, taking your last breath on your own terms, surrounded by the people that you love and that love you. I miss my mother terribly. And I remember when she was sick, I felt like every single cell in my body was splitting. But I can say and stand here before you to tell you that we experienced angels in the care that our family received. What it meant for my mom to die with dignity, our experience of care and caregiving was essential, and it is not the experience that so many families have across this nation. I spend most of my days trying to get people to take action around things that are important to our collective well-being. I've done that through the Black Lives Matter Global Network, ensuring that Black people are able to live full and dignified lives and not have those lives cut short by inadequate policing, by disinvestment, by criminalization, or by the myriad of other issues that make Black lives disposable. But before BLM, and to this day, I work with the National Domestic Workers Alliance, one of the nation's premier organizations fighting for the rights and respect of caregivers, child caregivers, elder caregivers, house cleaners, people who support independence for folks with disabilities. You see, domestic work and caregiving in this country is rooted in the legacy of slavery. And now the vestiges of that awful, terrible arrangement still exist in the industry itself. We work to make sure that caregivers can also care for themselves, that the work that caregivers perform is considered work. And we work to make sure that that work is paid like it's valued work. We work to make sure that caregiving is affordable, that it's quality, while also making sure that caregiving can actually be valued for the incredible contribution that it is. In the 1930s, domestic workers and agricultural workers were excluded from basic labor protections that other workers enjoyed. That was the result of a racist compromise between union leaders and Southern lawmakers. They were unwilling to ensure that Black workers and brown workers who comprised the vast majority of the sector would receive the same rights and protections as white workers. Today, we fight state by state to win rights and respect for the people who care for the people we care for the most. And we have won rights and protections for caregivers in 8 states across the nation. My family could not have made it without the care that we received. Caregivers are the backbone of our society and the backbone of our economy. Many caregivers in this country don't have the protections they need to make a wage that will allow them to care for their own families. More than 1 million caregivers in this country are not covered by basic labor protections, even though caregiving is one of the fastest growing sectors in our economy. Every 8 seconds in the United States, somebody turns 65, and we don't have enough caregivers to care for our aging population. Now, my mother was not old. She was 63. She had not had a long illness. She had not even retired yet. She and my dad had just bought a house in Northern California where they planned to live out the rest of their days together. They were talking about retirement, now that both of their children were grown and at least one of them was self-sufficient. And yet more and more people like me are in a position where they are caring for children and caring for their aging or ill parents. My story is a story like many others, an illness that seemingly comes from nowhere and lays even the best made plans aside. But my family had resources. My mother was meticulous about planning, and it paid off when she could no longer make decisions on her own behalf. We did not run into complications with insurance companies that didn't want to cover procedures, even though both of my parents were covered under the Affordable Care Act. We got into a facility with a weeks-long waiting list, and the reason was because the nurse recognized me and respected my work. Don't clap. She pulled strings to get us there. My family lives here. We're fourth-generation San Franciscans. We are a quickly dying breed. We all live within 2 hours of where my mother came to die. I had miles, I had money to be able to fly her twin brother out from Georgia here twice to be able to spend his best friend's last days with her. My family was not just fortunate. We had and we have privileges. Many people who need caregiving don't have access to those privileges. And not only is that unfair, it's criminal. My mother's death has impacted me in ways that I can't grasp and I have yet to know. But I can say that I had everything I needed available to me. What about those who don't? What do they do to die with dignity? What do their families do? Now, as I said before, this work has always been personal to me. My mother cleaned houses when I was younger to make ends meet. My grandmother was a caregiver for a family for 30 years. It was always personal to me. But it became even more personal when I needed to rely on caregiving, when I needed support in caring for my mom, when my mother was dying and I could not be there at every second like I wanted to be. Bless the caregivers who held her when she cried. Bless the caregivers who chased her around the hospital during manic moments of her illness. Caregiving is the work that makes all other work possible. So why aren't caregivers being cared for in return? Now, as a side note, the home that my mom died in, she was the last resident. A few short weeks after her death, I ran into her caregivers at a film festival for another friend who was then dying of cancer. My friend Alana valiantly fought for 2 years a rare form of gastrointestinal cancer before dying a month ago. When I saw those caregivers, I hugged them for a very long time, and they told me that they were given just a couple of weeks' notice, that soon they would not have jobs there anymore, that the house would be closing, and I recently learned that the house is put up for sale. Now that breaks my heart when I think about it. I was just getting up the resolve to go back, to go through the volunteer program and give back the care that my family received. I can't do that anymore. And it raises the question, why does our care infrastructure get left to nonprofits that rely on philanthropy and goodwill? Why is it not an embedded part of our city's infrastructure? And my friend Alana, who died a month ago, she did home hospice. And I can tell you her experience was not at all the same as my mother's. The caregiving was different. Process more formal and more isolating. There wasn't family care, just the bare minimum of patient care that was allowed by her insurance. I wish so much, even after her death, that she had that same level of care that my mom received. This is why movements are important. Movements have become a buzzword over the last few years, and people often want to know, how do I just add water to create a thing like you did? And I keep telling people, you can't add water and start a movement. Movements are not built from hashtags, and they're certainly not built from Twitter followers. They aren't built from small circles of people who already agree with each other. Movements are built by people who care, people who are directly impacted by an issue, people who come together to understand, why is this happening to us, and what are we going to do about it? In movements, we learn how to work together across difference for the sake of our collective liberation. In movements, we learn how not to leave anyone behind. We learn how to interrupt the wedges that are placed in between us. I've been a part of the domestic worker movement for about 5 years. I've been a part of many other movements for about 20 years. Don't let the baby face fool you. But I walked unknowingly and somewhat unwillingly into this movement around dying with dignity, a movement that seeks to change how we understand the role of death in our society, a movement that seeks to break the silence and the isolation of dying. This movement cares for people when they need and deserve care the most, and yet families and caregivers and those of us straddling both lines don't have the things we need to die with dignity or to support dignified dying. So here's my call to action. Keep going. Don't let caregiving be available only to the people who have access to financial services and resources. Don't let caregivers and their vital role be erased. Bring the different parts of this movement together so that we can be stronger and more dangerous together. The dignified dying movement, the domestic worker movement, the movement for affordable health care, the movement to end racism and sexism and homophobia and ableism, they are all connected. And we need each other desperately. Caregiving is facing a crisis in this country, and our voices are not loud enough alone. This room has to be multiplied by 1,000, by 100,000, by 1,000,000. We need each other to be successful. We need to change the composition of what these rooms look like and who is sitting in them. We need to ensure that the people who are doing the work are sitting in these seats and informing us of what a caring economy can be. We have no choice but to prevail, because what is at stake is dignity for all of us. Every single one of us is going to die at some point. Every single one of us needs and deserves care. So what's at stake? Being able to reach toward that which is our birthright. Please keep going. Thank you.
We've been listening to Alicia Garza delivering a presentation called Caregivers Are the Backbone of Our Society. Ms. Garza said we need each other, and we do. I hope that in future shows, we will be able to delve more deeply into the situation of unpaid and also paid caregivers, essential workers, as a matter of dignity at the end of life. This has been Body Politic. I am your host, Dr. Nurse Nancy. You can hear Body Politic on the first and third Monday of every month at 95.9 FM in Bozeman, or stream us live. Most shows are also available anytime at kgvm.org.